Today's program has been brought to you by Hearst Ranch, the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. For more information, visit HearstRanch.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome back to The Speakeasy. I'm your host, Damon Bolte. In the studio today, we have my good buddy, Justin Lane Briggs. Welcome to the show. It's been, I think I asked you probably about 2 years ago on this show, probably when I first met you, and it was probably when we were drinking a bunch of chartreuse.
That's probably true, yeah. Yeah, it's been a while since we first talked about it and since it's actually happened, I suppose.
Yeah, and thanks for finally making it.
My pleasure. It's good to be here.
You almost hit... I think this is like episode 97 or 8.
Oh, sweet. We're coming up to the 100, huh?
Yeah, you're going to have to come back on the 100. geez, you've been into a lot since we first met a couple of years ago.
That's true, yeah. Been all over the place. I don't know. Where do you want me to begin?
You know what? Begin at the beginning. How did you get into all of this, man?
All right, cool. Let's see.
Who is Justin Lane?
God, get ready for my life story. I think, you know, when I try to think about where I began in terms of making a career out of beverages, I trace it back much further than alcoholic beverages. I started out, you know, I grew up in Vermont, surrounded by the organic farming community up there. My father was like heavily involved with NOFA, the National Organic Farmers Association. I worked at a little food co-op up there when I was growing up. I became passionate about things I could drink from a pretty early age. You know, I remember actually one of my first memories in those terms was going to an Orange Julius and becoming obsessed with Orange Julius and trying to recreate it over and over and over again at home until I got what I thought was it, you know?
Did you ever figure out the secret?
I'd like to think so.
You probably don't want to share it.
No, I'm totally down.
You're probably getting sued by Orange Julius.
Maybe.
We need them as a sponsor.
Yeah, they're definitely in on heritage food, I know. The way I do it is kind of a riff on, I guess now that I know a little bit more, a riff on, I only know my own French name for it now, which is not the actual name. It's a Mexican beverage as well. When I make it, I call it Le Petit Mort, which is, you know, obviously a little joke there. But to die dreaming, morir soñando. There we go. So I do a whole egg. I do some orange. I do some cream. I do some vanilla syrup. Nowadays, back in the day when I was younger, I needed a little bit of sugar and a little bit of vanilla extract. But I don't know. I guess when I was growing up, I would blend the hell out of it, and nowadays I shake the hell out of it and do it like a flip, but a non-alcoholic one. Or I like to add a little bit of gin and sweet vermouth, a la a sweet Bronx cocktail with Orange Julius instead of orange juice, I guess you could say.
That's badass.
Yeah, it's pretty tasty too. And you kind of get there. Anyway, when I was when I was growing up and I went to Orange Julius at the local mall and became obsessed with it, like I've got to figure this out. So that kind of started me off, on things I could drink. And then when I started working at the local food co-op, I became obsessed with, you know, beverages in general. So I kind of became the beverage manager for a while there and was, you know, picking the ciders, picking the organic sodas, picking, you know, those sorts of things out. And, it was a small place, so it wasn't really that much responsibility, but it was a lot of fun. And it exposed me to the idea of thinking about flavors that I imbibed. And so when I moved to New York City years later and was trying to put myself through school, I guess actually like to step back, a moment, right before I moved to New York City, or actually not even right before, just a little bit ways before I moved to New York City. When I was trying to, I guess, keep on earning my keep in Vermont, I had a few friends who were bartending at, like, you know, the local Friendlies or the Irish pub downtown, that kind of thing. And I always looked at what they were doing and was like, that seems like the sweet gig, you know? Like, you get to hang out, even though you're underage, you probably drink a couple drinks, yeah. You meet girls, you know, you have fun, and it just looks like a good time. And you walk with cash usually, you know, God, that sounds great, you know? It's
like, what's wrong? There's nothing wrong with this situation.
Right, exactly, yeah. Like, why am I working on this farm right now? why am I working at this, you know, I don't know, whatever else I was doing. Why am I a bricklayer? So I tried, you know, started getting like small gigs there, and then, you know, very briefly upstate New York, and you know, while I was kind of like wandering around and trying to figure my stuff out, very briefly anyway. So when I got to New York, I was like, all right, obviously this is the place to be a bartender, and this is like the gig to go for while I'm trying to pay my way through college. And once I found a job that actually, you know, paid decently for bartending in New York, I wound up landing at the Mermaid Inn in the East Village, and was behind the bar there. This is back when there was only one Mermaid Inn in the East Village. No Uptown, no Oyster Bar, nothing like that. And what turned me from a bartender who was there just trying to make some cash into a bartender who really gave a damn was, there was really, I can pinpoint one customer. There was one dude who came in all the time, and like three times a week. And I was there a lot, and he was there a lot. And he would always order martinis and Manhattans, which at the time I was thinking, sweet, you know, this guy just drinks a whole lot of these drinks that are two ingredients, and I can just bang them out and it doesn't really matter. You know, I just throw the drink at him. And maybe like 6 months into having him as a regular, he says to me, yeah, you know, your cocktails are all right. And I found myself thinking, what the hell? Like, they're all right. There's two ingredients, asshole. Like, how can this be all right? How can I be screwing that up? Like, how isn't that great? You know, I mean, I feel like I did it the way I was taught to. You know, I shook my Manhattan the way I was supposed to. So
I dumped a bunch of cherry juice in it like I was supposed to.
Yeah, exactly. So I was incensed, because I've got, I guess, a bit of a competitive streak, because I've got a bit of a pride streak. I turned around and said, you know, all right, I want to make you the best damn Manhattan you've had. I want to make you the best damn martini you've had. And so I started reading about drinks, and I started going to places that I knew had great cocktail programs, places where I knew people gave a damn about their drinks. And so I would go and watch what they were doing. And I started, the first thing obviously that I learned was, don't shake your damn Manhattan or your martini. You know? But I started trying to educate myself about these things. And the minute I started that, to backstep a tiny bit, again, my parents are both, you know, farmers and activists and all kinds of things. But one of the things that they both are is anthropologists with a focus on folklore and, folk songs, folk tales, etc. And historians. And when I started to delve into cocktail history, it dawned on me that this was a lot like that. An element to which cocktails are almost like folk music. You know, the way that, let's say, you know, a bluegrass tune, you know, everybody has their own version. You know, there's Woody Guthrie's version, and then somebody else learned it, and then somebody else learned it, and you kind of pass it down by word of mouth, by execution, by so when you learn a cocktail recipe, especially before, you know, the current era when we all kind of are sharing from some of the same sources, there were moments when how you made your X, how you made your Y, had to do with who taught you and had to do with what lineage you were a part of. And it's a, you know, it's an oral tradition. It's a shared history.
Right.
And I got really excited about that. And I started thinking, you know, all right, this is a truly American art form. This is a culinary art form that we've lost. And this is a folk tradition to some degree. And there's a lot of room to get excited about that, especially as the child, again, of historians, you know, who are into that kind of thing. So I started really pursuing it and really educating myself. And the second side of that coin was, the more I got into cocktails and started to learn about spirits, started to learn about ingredients and syrups and all those sorts of things, it started to dawn on me that these were all agricultural products too. So again, there was a relationship between that and, you know, how I define myself, my upbringing. You know, there's a relationship between that and the farming community I grew up around, that there was a disconnect that was happening a lot of the time, but you know, for a lot of customers, between, you know, wheat that's grown or rye grain that's grown and the whiskey that's made from it. But at the end of the day, it's still an agricultural product, and what's happening is we're applying, you know, human effort to what that agriculture produces. And so you have these two sides of that coin happening at the same time, and I related to both of them, and it was sort of like, how have I not been into this before? How did I not get this before? You know, like what have I been waiting for? So all of a sudden, I couldn't really think about much else.
Yeah.
And plus, I got to get drunk doing it.
I feel like I'm talking to myself right now. Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, like, and, you know, especially with, like you were saying, like the folk art of it, you know, bitters being folk medicine, which we'll talk about here in a little bit. I know you started making some bitters, which are delicious. I just got to try them.
True.
And then, like, even, you know, that being said, using folk medicine and then mixing that with, you know, the bitters with the agricultural distillates and ingredients, it is like a very, it is a folk culinary art, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Totally. And like you said, you, so recently you just started making some bitters, for, Cecil and Merle.
I did. Yeah. Yeah. Cecil and Merle out of Prospect Heights. They're a lovely small, like, artisanal goods line out of, they're the same folks who did James Restaurant in Prospect Heights, mm-hmm. Brian Calvert and Deborah Williamson. And they tapped me. I used to be their bar manager years ago, over at James, and they tapped me to come and do bitters. I've been working on bitters exclusively on premise and, you know, for home use. Although less the latter, I suppose. Money is an incentive.
Yeah.
I've been working on bitters for like the last 5 years or so. Mm-hmm. And so when they tapped me to come and design some bitters for them, it seemed like an opportune moment to really push, I guess, volume production and really see how that changes when you aren't just doing 2 gallons, 1 gallon, a quarter of a gallon, sure, at a time. And also to fill what I saw as a gap in terms of the way that I like to make drinks, I suppose. Yeah. Which is weird to say considering how many bitters are on the market. There's so many.
Yeah. It's kind of overwhelming, especially when you go into stores like culinary shops to find like that bitters, you know, especially for someone who's like an enthusiast or like a novice to come in, mm-hmm. like you really need to have like basically like a bitters sommelier at the store to like walk you through like the differences between all of them.
Yeah. Oh, totally. For example, so the only flavor I've produced so far for them is cherry, and you know, there's at least 4 other cherry bitters out there. I'm sure there's more. You know, there's dramatic differences between each of those. You know, there's so many aromatic bitters that are specifically, you know, not a toned flavor, but a broad aromatic kind of quality. Here, let me pour you some.
Okay, cool.
Taste it out.
Yeah, I mean, like, I tasted a little bit. I dashed a little bit earlier on the back of my hand, and I have to say, it was like the most like pronounced cherry flavor of any of the cherry bitters that I've had so far.
Why? Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, a lot of them rely on the other ingredients, the other bittering agents, barrel aging, those kinds of things. But these are extremely good.
It's a little bit of cherry bitters and soda right there. I mean, yeah, exactly. The idea for me was that I wanted something that was really just bit, you know, cherry focused and still bitter, rather than, you know, letting things like vanilla, like supporting characters, step forward too hard.
These are great, and they're really still standing up in the seltzer water.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. I kind of want to put some in my cider here.
Ah, sweet. Do it. Do it.
I think I will.
Ah, cider.
Yeah, we'll dash them into our cider, and then we'll talk about the outcome after this break. Right back in a moment with Justin Lean Briggs.
Right on.
You are listening to Easy Riding Child by Brothers NYC. Keep it locked here on Heritage Radio Network.
Go to sleep, child, in the morning I'm gone. Because 12 hours here is 12 hours too long. 30 odd years, man, was like a crystal red. Missing name, missing child, and your sister. 30 odd years, man, I've always known. Trouble always starts on that open road. Trouble
a heart and my heart's got a roll. So I fill it with the fuel that keeps me going.
What's that, man?
Whiskey, girl, sex, drugs, rock and roll. Rock and roll, girl.
Welcome back to The Speakeasy. We're sitting in the studio today with Justin Lane Briggs. Yo. He just turned me on to his Cecil and Marl cherry bitters, and I just put some in my British hard cider, and I gotta say, it's probably my new drink of the summer now. If anybody out there needs the recipe, we'll post it on the Heritage website, but I can just tell you right now, it's cider and cherry bitters, so there you go. But we were just talking about it before the show, like... making a cherry bitters, and there are a lot of bitters out there on the market, and like what's cool about this one to me is that you tend to, there's this whole thing about, like, you know, the QB cooler being the precursor to the Mai Tai, but it's less ingredients and you get kind of a better drink, you know. And being like a mixologist and a bartender, a drinks maker, drinks designer, if you will, it's great to have products like this to where you can kind of like knock out some steps and like actually get that flavor without having to take other steps to achieve that, you know? And I've been saying this like ever since I started doing the show, but it's like the most exciting time because we have cool ingredients constantly coming out on the market, you know, that we can use to make new drinks, you know, and like new cocktails. One of like our pastry chefs uses, she always comes to the bar and grabs stuff, and you know, she's using these cool new ingredients to even bake with, you know. It's like super exciting on all fronts. But also you get to see how, like we were talking about before, you know, like there's so many friends of mine are farmers and they get to like make something. I mean, that's how like all these spirits came around. It's like using, exactly, using your crops, like we were talking about before, and like basically preserving them in a way that's not like a jelly or a jam. It's like, let's distill that shit. Because, you said at the end of what you were saying before, it's like, and I get to get drunk.
Yeah. I mean, making alcohol out of your produce is as old as anything humans do, really, you know? Yeah. It goes back to, like, Sumeria.
Yeah.
Like, that is not a new idea, you know? Which I guess actually kind of segues nicely into my other plug. little work here again. I'm also working right now for a vermouth from Oregon. Imbue vermouth. If anybody sees it out there, try it. It's really good. You know, vermouth, it's funny, because, yeah, please grab those cups and taste some, Damon. Thank you. Nice job. Yes, I want some. I should note at this point that I'm drinking with Damon, and it has been a month, if you're counting February as a month, since I've had a drink. So this is a big moment for me. Anyway,
that's what they all say when they come on this show.
I wouldn't drink except for you. What was I saying? Oh, no.
Vermouth.
Yeah, thank you. It's funny because, you know, there's this resurgence of vermouth and aromatized wines going on right now. And vermouth really, you know, is, you know, we've kind of relegated it to being a mixer, to being something that you put, or even like, just as, you know, who Churchill said, you know, just look at it as you make your martini, that kind of thing.
Right.
But really it's a beverage in its own right and has been for a lot longer than pretty much anything else besides just wine and beer, you know,
right.
just basic fermentation. You know, there was Chinese vermouth with wormwood, you know, vermouth, wormwood, you know,
yeah,
vermouth, back in like 1000 BC, you know, we've had vermouth, we've had aromatized wine forever, and we stopped drinking it the way we did around Prohibition. Like a lot of good things.
Right.
And we're just kind of reinvestigating that now. So, you know, there's been the rise of domestic vermouth. So here we are with a pretty cool one.
This one's really cool to me because it's super, I don't know, it's super floral in the nose.
Mm-hmm.
It's that kind of like an elderflower kind of.
There's elderflower.
Apple. Yeah.
There's chamomile, you know.
But, I mean, like, but then on the palate, it's not, like, it's kind of like the perceived sweetness, like on the nose, you'd think it'd be sweeter than it is, but it's got like all those great like spice characters, and like it just really, it's like stands alone on its own, like you said, you know. And you know, drinking this like on the rocks, you know, with a twist, I mean, I could do that all day. In fact, I've proven that point.
Yeah, exactly. I love a glass. I mean, right now is also with the warm weather, it's like the time for that kind of thing.
Oh yeah,
I love vermouth all summer on the rocks. It's so good. But it also, you know, specifically this and other vermouths that are coming up now, you know, I love what, like, Bianca's doing with Uncouth. I love what, you know, so many people are doing these days domestically and you know, to a lesser degree abroad. I mean, I love a lot of vermouths from abroad, but that's not going to make the point I want to make right now, which is that there's, you know, it comes back to that sense of agricultural awareness, too. You know, for example, what we're doing with Imbue is focused also on the sense of terroir and the grape and where it's from. It's from Willamette Valley. It's Pinot Gris, and it's really trying to focus both on the grape and the way the wine functions, as well as the flavors that you're infusing into it. So check that stuff out. Anyway,
yeah, I mean, like, I go back to you. Well, I keep looking at my cider and this vermouth and then the cherry bitters, and I'm just like about to freak out. I'm like, by the end of the show, they're all going to be mixed together.
That'd be interesting.
Yeah, but you know, like Willamette Valley is like one of the most badass wine producing parts of the country now.
Totally. Yeah. And it's almost a no brainer to connect the dots. I mean, it really is a collaboration between bartenders and wine. Well, a bartender, a winemaker. Really, it's about trying to explore what both people bring to the table in those terms, and what it's like when you treat both aspects of that with that kind of culinary and agricultural approach. But I've done enough plugging. let's move on to something else.
No. Well, I actually just want to talk about vermouth and cocktails for a little while too. You know, you were talking about shaking your Manhattans and martinis, and like, and now we're talking about vermouth. And when you started making, what was your approach to a martini? Did you put vermouth in it at all?
Oh yeah, no, I did. But I did, like, you know, I basically kind of turned the bottle upside down for a half a second
and
pulled it away when I first made those. You know, nowadays I kind of swear by the 2-to-1, although I like a 50-50.
Absolutely. Me too.
I mean, you know, again, you know, all right, damn
it. But things have changed a lot since we started bartending, though. You know, like, we didn't have good vermouth back then. So that's, you know, like, of course, like, when I started drinking martinis, I always wanted them, like, bone dry.
Uh-huh.
But I have to say, I always drink mine with gin.
Me too, absolutely, you know. But that being said, you know, also the vermouth that I was being exposed to was that same vermouth that's been sitting on the back bar
for 15
warm.
Years.
Warm, yeah, exactly. Or even for a month. But, you know, it's just warm. It's not being refrigerated. It's not being cared for the way you would a wine, the way you would an aromatized wine with low proof. You know, you're not... I was drinking a rotten product every time I drank it, you know?
Right.
So it's funny to now be trying to re-educate people and say, you know, listen, like, vermouth is a beverage and you should, you know, love it and treat it with respect, but also you should probably take care of it, because otherwise it's going to spoil and you're going to think it's gross and you won't like it in your drink anymore.
Yeah, you have to drink it before it goes bad. So, you know, as soon as you open it,
down the hatch.
Just turn it up, man. But yeah, I mean, like, one of my old bartenders, Cabell Tomlinson, she went to Italy and brought me back a bottle of Carpano Classico and the weird, like, 965 milliliter bottle that you can't get here. But, like, I just remember, like, loving Carpano Antica and then tasting the Carpano Classico formula, which was just, like, even more bitter and, like, more lush and just, like, mind-blowing. And I really did. I mean, I think it was, like, me and a couple of friends finished it in one seating. And it was like, one of the happiest moments of my life.
Don't blame you.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, like, going to that, like, I remember, like, the guy who actually taught me how to make martinis, it was kind of mind blowing when he taught me to stir it instead of shake it.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, what the hell are you doing? This is crazy. And he's like,
this takes longer.
Yeah. It's like, and it's not going to be as cold, man. But, I do remember, him, like, I think he probably used about a half ounce to, like, 2.5 ounces of vodka or gin, or I can't remember what it was. I think it was like Bombay Sapphire or something like that.
Yeah.
But even that blew my mind, you know. This is actually, like, before I started bartending, but he taught me that, and, like, he did it with a twist instead of olives. It wasn't dirty. It was, like, and it was just, like, the coolest, crispest, like, coolest thing. And I felt so cool about it, you know, especially because, you know, in Oklahoma, like, even when I started drinking Manhattans, I would always ask for them with a twist instead of a cherry, because back then we were still getting all those crappy cherries, like, that, you know, in the jar with, that's like neon red.
Oh, yeah. If anybody out there has ever read about how those are made, also, I don't want to talk about it because it's disgusting.
It is disgusting. We can take a trip to Red Hook and I can show you.
Go read it if you want to be really disturbed. It's horrible.
Yeah, it's pretty bad.
It's horrible.
But yeah, I mean, like,
It's those like defining moments, like where, like you said, when you figured out the secret of the Orange Julius, and you had that realization where the agricultural side and the historical side came into play with what you wanted to do with beverages. Those are those like defining moments in your life when everything clicks and you're just like, wow, mm-hmm. this is such a cool thing to be into, and like that you immediately you just want to share it with everyone.
Exactly, especially because you look around and you think, you know, I feel like so many people aren't, you know, don't see this. Why won't you see this? Like, draw the lines. You know, you kind of want to grab people and say, listen, you know, this thing you're drinking was a grape, or this thing you're drinking was an apple, or it was, you know, some corn or some rye, and someone grew that, and how they did it probably makes an impact on what you're drinking right now.
Dude, I think you and I have a project in the future, because I've always wanted to do this. I've always wanted to make, I mean, even if it's only one bottle, I want to
one-off.
I want to like go to my farm in Oklahoma, get some, either grow some corn or some wheat. Normally, it's wheat that we have growing. We used to grow corn back in the day, but from start to finish, grow the crop, harvest it, macerate it, distill that shit, age it, and the trees that we have in my farm, they're all like pecan trees. But that'd be kind of cool, like pecan.
Hell yeah.
Aged, but then
pecan barrels.
Pecan barrels, yeah, man. Age in that, then you know. Strain it out, but get like some sand from the beach of the lake where I grew up, melt it down, make a bottle. I used to work in printing and design
the label.
Like, dude, like every single part of it, like fully hands on. I think between you and I, we could probably make that happen.
I think you're right.
The only thing is I don't have any cork trees.
Well,
figure something out.
I think my dad may have a bottling, like a bottle cap thing. We could just do a, you know, a pop top, and somebody has to find their own damn cork.
That's great. Well, you know, or we could just whittle one out of one of those dicks in the woods.
There you
just
go.
Just shove it in.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, cool. Justin, God, it was so great having you on the show today, man.
Man, that half hour flew by.
It always does, especially when you're drinking good vermouth with good friends and great bitters.
Cheers, right on.
And bitters in the cider, you know.
Well, thank you. Please come
drink of the summer.
Everybody out there, please come visit me at Barbess on Mondays also over in Park Slope, a little music venue. And yeah. Please come visit Damon at Prime Meats and please have drinks with us.
I'll be there on Monday, so come visit us on Monday. All right, that's it for the Speakeasy this week. Justin, thank you so much. Come on again anytime you'd like.
Thank you. I would love to.
All right, we'll see you next week. That's it. Cheers.
Cheers.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.